Some of you, maybe you fellow aging baby boomers, may recognize the title of this morning's sermon, Wild Thing You Make My Heart Sing. It is the opening line to a 1964 proto-punk rock and roll hit called Wild Thing. The next line in that historic pop tune is, Wild Thing, you know I love you, but I want to know for sure. It goes on, Wild Thing, you make my heart sing, you make everything groovy. Wild Thing, I think you move me, but I want to know for sure. That little pop tune ditty has lodged itself somewhere deep in my brain. I suspect the ancient reptilian section, and is all but impossible to erase as much as I want to on occasion. The song was appropriately written and performed by the Trogs, short for the Troglodytes, famous from H.G. Wells' novel, The Time Machine. Well, the song does take us back. I was, I think, 15 or 16 years old when I saw the Trogs perform that one and only hit song in a teen nightclub in Lima, Ohio in 1966. I couldn't remember all of the lyrics, but found that opening phrase captivating, Wild Thing, you make my heart sing. Regrettably, after Googling the lyrics, I discovered that they were definitely not in the same league as Walt Whitman or Mary Oliver. The words are little more than steamy teenage sexuality, which is probably why they lodged themselves in my primitive brain so many years ago. This week, I found myself wondering what the lyrics might have been if Walt Whitman had written a song by that title, Wild Thing. I rediscovered these lines of poetry by Walt Whitman with which such a song might be composed. I think I could turn and live with the animals, they're so placid and self-contained. I stand and look at them long and long. They do not sweat and whine about their condition. They do not lie awake in the dark and weep for their sins. They do not make me sick discussing their duty to God. Not one is dissatisfied, not one is demented with the mania of owning things. Not one kneels to another, nor to his kind that lived thousands of years ago. Not one is respectable or unhappy over the whole earth. This is the direction my reflections take today, accompanied by that line singing in my head, Wild Thing, you make my heart sing, Wild Thing, I think I love you. Walt Whitman and Mary Oliver understand the important connection between the natural world in which we live and the natural interior world of our subjective self. Did you know that the word animal derives from the word anima, which translates as soul? This is the thread that weaves together this morning's worship service. To acknowledge one's own soul is to acknowledge the animal or wild thing within. But the anima, one's animal soul, is very different than one is commonly led to imagine. In my troglodyte adolescence, I resonated with the common notions of wildness, pointing toward savageness, ecstasy, the excessive, what the song Wild Thing is actually all about, irresponsible teenage sexual passion. These popular notions of savage, primitive wildness are steeped in a 2,000-year-old Christian sentiment that polarizes and then projects a wild, devilish immorality on the natural, fallen world. This Christian vision of the world is painted in dark hues to create a bold contrast with a civilized, light-filled Christian moral order. But these pious notions of the wild actually have little understanding of the real animal world with its balanced ecological order and what it truly means to be wild. Fact is, animals are neither innocent nor guilty, neither pure nor corrupt, for those are strictly human categories. Indeed, if we were to envy animals, it's precisely because they live outside such categories. And here we come to the heart of the matter. For what would it mean to experience our own actions in such a way that the social conventions of good and bad don't apply? It would mean living like animals, without doubt as to our life's purpose. So writes my good friend Phil Simmons in a sermon he delivered a few years before his early death from Lou Gehrig's disease, or ALS. In Phil's spiritual journey and search for peace during his debilitating illness, the animals became Phil's teachers. Phil discovered the wisdom of the wild. According to Phil, if we were to live like the animals, it would mean rising each day to forage or feed, to shelter and care for our young, to laze or labor, fight or frolic, without distraction, without self-judgment, without taking one step off life's true path. And even in the face of misery and terror, even as we may walk through the valley of the shadow of death, even as the sleet freezes our hides or the hawk descends upon us, it would mean living in the faith that this too is the way. It would mean living in such perfect alignment with what purpose that every act flowed effortlessly from what is highest and truest within us. Imagine living in such a fashion, and you might begin to imagine what I mean by becoming a wild thing. One of my favorite meditations in our Unitarian Universalist hymn book is in Singing the Living Tradition is Mary Oliver's Wild Geese. So please turn to 490 in the responsive readings and join with me in its recitation. You do not have to be good. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the wild geese high in the clean blue air are heading home again. In Mary Oliver's vision, it is the wild world that offers itself to the spiritual imagination, thereby turning upside down the commonplace notions of spiritual development as transcendent, with humankind evolving into a disembodied heavenly spiritual abstraction. Like Mary Oliver, I have come to appreciate Darwin's vision of the descent of man from the animal world as a mythological statement, as well as a biological statement. The descent of man says that man is indeed lower than the ape, who is superior in the wisdom of nature, and who is man's angel as nearest intermediary with the natural aspect of the divine. Also, Freud's development from Darwin equated our animal self with the biological id, infantile sexuality, and the principle of pleasure. It took others to see how his vision could be inverted mythically, allowing us to see our animal nature, the id and infantile sexuality, as a vital repository expressing the creative fantasies of the wisdom of nature. I have a friend, Robert Inkowski, who teaches American literature to undergraduates in San Luis Obispo, California. And a number of years ago, while a minister in Deerfield, Illinois, I brought him to the Central Midwest Ministers' Fall Retreat. We had a wonderful time talking about our shared enthusiasm for the American Transcendentalists. He shared with me his experience of teaching Emerson and Whitman to his young college students. I told him I believe Emerson was and still is the greatest exponent of a Unitarian Universalism today, and how I like to hand out a selection of quotations by Emerson along with passages from Whitman's Leaves of Grass to visitors and church members attending my introduction to Unitarian Universalism class. The quotations include a series of admonitions Emerson made to the graduating class of Harvard Divinity School 180 years ago. Perhaps I should remind you that Emerson was a third-generation Unitarian minister. He abandoned the ministry after a few years, telling his Boston congregation that he could no longer in good conscience serve Holy Communion. For those who have not read Emerson since high school, you will find many of Emerson's passages read to the novice as if he were paraphrasing Walt Whitman in his preface to The Leaves of Grass I just read. The truth, however, is that it was Whitman who was giving poetic expression in his Leaves of Grass to Emerson's profoundly prophetic post-Christian democratic vision of the new man and woman, the new Adam and Eve living in a wild new world called America, envisioned as a new Eden in the wilderness wherein nature is reclaimed as our most holy book. This new world was to be distinguished from the old world of European, aristocratic, monarchic, Christian culture. It is hard for us today to comprehend the measure of Emerson's significance. He was not only the continental divide of our Unitarian religious tradition, articulating the American Unitarian Association's move towards a trans-Christian or post-Christian identity, one in which human history and the natural world became our Bible, critical thinking our authority, the human imagination the crucible for our spiritual discipline. Emerson's importance has been recognized by many outside our faith. He has been described by none other than the late great American philosopher John Dewey as the Socrates of American philosophy, and by the famous American literary critic Harold Bloom as the father of American letters and literature, against whom all great American writers and poets must measure their own creative genius. It was in the year of 1838 when Emerson was invited by the graduating class of Harvard Divinity School to present the commencement address. He delivered a blistering indictment of the domesticated churches of America, more specifically the Unitarian churches of his day, describing their theological school, Harvard, as operating like a taxidermist, destroying the wild living soul of the young men. There were no women at that time in seminary, who came to be trained as ministers and filling them with the sawdust of antiquated dogmas. Emerson admonished those young aspiring Harvard Divinity School graduates to not allow themselves to be domesticated, compelled to live within the confines of an old and dying order. Emerson said to them, "Thou shalt not profess that which thou dost not believe. Thou shalt not heed the voice of man when it agrees not with the voice of thine own soul. Thou shalt study and obey the laws of the universe, and they shall be thy fellow servants. Thou shalt speak the truth as thou seest it, without fear, in the spirit of kindness to all thy fellow creatures. Let thy soul be open, and thine eyes will reveal to thee beauty everywhere." Well, this is pretty powerful stuff, particularly in the early 1800s, not only for those aspiring Unitarian ministers, but the undergraduate students in American literature classes today, and for all of us who are wild at heart, struggling against the forces of domestication and conformity. My friend Robert described to me the power of Emerson and Whitman on his students by telling me how, after teaching his American literature class one quarter, a Vietnamese student, Thai, came to his class to thank him for the class. He told her that no thanks was necessary, that teaching was his job, and he got paid for it. "No," she insisted, "you don't understand. Ever since I came here from Vietnam, my parents have been telling me how great America is, but I could never see it. All I could see were shopping malls, bad television shows, and fancy cars. But after taking your class, I now know what makes America great." "Tell me," Robert asked this young Vietnamese girl, "what makes America great?" She looked him right in the eye and said with reverence, "Ralph Waldo Emerson." It was a moving moment for my friend Robert. He teaches Emerson all the time, so it's easy to forget how life-changing Emerson's liberating vision can be, how heady his bold assertions of human potential, how comforting his acknowledgement of solitude as the natural ally of every true individual. Thai then read him her credo, her statement of faith and affirmation. It was the passage from the introduction to Whitman's Leaves of Grass. "This is what you shall do. Love the earth, the sun, and the animals. despise riches, and so on. As she read it, Robert almost wept. She had found in Whitman a succinct summary of the finest American virtues, a generous and inclusive spirituality, the rejection of pretense and status, an admiration for the outcast and the outsider, the love of the earth and the animals, perhaps the most important of all, the need to see the transcendent, the divine, in the human and natural world, and the Word of God, in our human animal flesh. As Robert shared the story with me during the evening of our minister's retreat, I began to sing the song of the Trogs. Wild thing, you make my heart sing. Wild thing, I think I love you. Wild thing, you make everything so groovy. We laughed and toasted Emerson and Whitman and all the men and women who we have known who are wild at heart and all the wild things of the world. It's not surprising that at the threshold of this young Vietnamese woman's discovery of America stood the most revolutionary prophet of them all. Walt Whitman, old Father Graybeard, the great gray gay poet of democracy, rendering Emerson's thought into the voice of the common man and woman. Whitman has been described as the American Jesus, the American Jesus, by our country's leading literary critic, Harold Bloom. According to Bloom, Emerson, Whitman, and their ever-unfolding legacy is American culture's holy trinity. Father, Emerson, son, Whitman, and America's Holy Spirit. The deep American dream, and we, the dreamers, dreaming it forward. Walt Whitman was exactly what Thay was looking for after escaping Vietnamese communism, the confirmation of all her secret wishes, the proof that there was a spiritual tradition in this country after all. America really does possess a self-conscious understanding of its own radical egalitarianism, and there were and are, maybe even some here present in this church of the free spirit, who live in the light of that unfolding revelation of word and flesh. What I found out recently is that Thay went on to graduate school at Emerson College in Boston. She went there largely because of its name, I understand. She wanted to be an Emersonian, and she wanted her external circumstances to reflect her own inner reality. She graduated and continues to communicate with Robert, her favorite teacher, telling him about her ongoing efforts to see through the world's pretensions and dismiss whatever insults her own soul. I want to encourage all of you who are still wild at heart, whose souls are hungry for wild wisdom, to read the Transcendentalists. Read them or reread them with new devotion. Emerson, Whitman, Thoreau, their books are the holy scripture of both American Unitarianism and our nation. Emerson, the mentor and 15 years the senior to both Thoreau and Whitman, set the tone for them and all American writers by calling imitation suicidal and by calling on men and women to embark on an adventure in soul making, to embark on an experiment in making the selves that they were by nature the goal of their endeavors. And I hope their liberating words strike as deep a chord in you as they did in Thay. The hope, the idea that each of us possesses untapped potential, that a courageous faith is an aid in making one's potential actual, and that self-actualization and engagement in a truly creative and democratic community are the ultimate ends of civilization. That these are goals to which you, like Thay, would also aspire. I asked Robert if Thay was representative of the other students in his class at San Luis Obispo. He told me that there are a large number of immigrants, especially Hispanic and Asian immigrants in his classes, as well as native-born Americans like most of us. He pointed out an important distinction he finds in many of his students. Far too many native-born or natural Americans pursue a form of knowledge that must always have a material, if not immediate, payoff. They are in large part success seekers, bent on going their parents and their peers one better, not necessarily by achieving any greater understanding of themselves or the world, but by getting more of what everyone else seems to want and making good on other people's missed opportunities. They are not particularly moral beings, he said. They live on the surface of things, ambitious and pragmatic to a fault, alive to the cultural images before them and the external trappings of pleasure and success, but they are dull to the interior life with its visionary possibilities and the call of conscience. They are less interested in making sense of their situation than they are in acquiring pleasure, status, power, and control. Robert said, unlike many of the immigrants, the native-born Americans do not judge their achievements against the moral and intellectual progress of humankind, but rather against the accomplishment of their peers and the lives and leisure of millionaires and celebrities. However, Robert went on to add another important observation. He finds that Americans are not really occupied from within by corporate media images, so much as they are isolated from their own inherent idealism and America's heroic past. Americans substitute postures of ironic self-defense, he said. They live a life of feigned indifference, longing for sincerity, but incapable of imagining what it would be like to actually experience it. Americans have lost the connection to their anima soul, with a sharp animal instinct for both freedom and belonging to both the human community and the natural world. The difficulties we face as Americans, young and old alike, is the clash between our true and false selves, between our desire to control and manipulate life to achieve material success, and our desire to throw off every form of internal and external tyranny so as to live a true life. Roar! As our transcendentalist forebears yearn to do, but that true life will be first and foremost an interior accomplishment. Let me explain. What is my advice to all of you who are still wild at heart and want to dispel and see through the cultural trance? When the forces of domestication are assaulting you, knocking on the doors and windows of your hearts and minds, wanting your soul in exchange for status and success. I hear the bleating of sheep when I say that. Follow the advice of the American poet Wendell Berry, a writer too in the great American tradition. He has a wonderful poem I love sharing with young people coming of age. It's called Do Not Be Ashamed. You will be walking some night in the comfortable dark of your yard, and suddenly a great light will shine round about you, and behind you will be a wall you never saw before. It will be clear to you suddenly that you were about to escape and that you are guilty. You misread the complex instructions. You are not a member. You lost your card or never had one. And you will know that they have been there all along, their eyes on your letters and books, their hands in your pockets, their ears wired to your bed. Though you have done nothing shameful, they will want you to be ashamed. They will want you to kneel and weep and say you should have been like them. And once you say you are ashamed, reading the page they hold out to you, then such a light as you have made in your history will leave you. They will no longer need to pursue you. You will pursue them, begging forgiveness. They will not forgive you. There is no power against them. It is only candor that is aloof from them, only an inward clarity, unashamed, they cannot reach. Be ready. When their light has picked you out and their questions are asked, say to them, I am not ashamed. And a sure horizon will come around you. And the heron will begin his evening flight from the hilltop. The spirit of Emerson and Whitman is alive in Wendell Berry, reminding us that our faith rests In the glory of the individual, the divinity that shines forth through the human, the trepository, the wild human anima soul. Soul, soul, and evermore soul, nothing is at last sacred but the integrity of your own mind, wrote Ralph Waldo Emerson. This is the exaltation of the greatest prophet of the free church and the soul of America, the highest expression of a God-filled soul who would have us fill our souls with the same natural divine substance, to find our noblest, highest, and best selves and live freely and creatively with one another.
Roar!
Wendell Berry, Mary Oliver, Walt Whitman, Henry David Thoreau, Ralph Waldo Emerson, all of them extolled the virtues of solitude. It is easy in the world to live after the world's opinion, Emerson wrote. It is easy in solitude to live after our own, but the great man and woman is one who, in the midst of the crowd, keeps with perfect sweetness the independence of solitude. In the mental and moral equipment of a free thinker, this realization, the welcoming of solitude, is of the essence. Without it, you will never learn how to stand apart from the mob and the forces of conformity, and truly think for yourself. But to do so, you must cultivate the capacity to go into internal exile, and live against the stream. With time, the experience of going into internal exile, reclaiming the experience of solitude, will begin to open a space within you. This space could be called your own personal wildlife preserve. A space where your wild selves, your psyche's wild animal nature, and the soft flesh of your animal body can breathe and find room to roam. With practice and devotion, you will find yourself living more and more inside the wildlife preserve, a place which you will come to recognize as your true and only home. Thoreau said that the most alive is the wildest. We don't go into wildness, both interior and exterior, to escape our lives, but rather to return to them, to return to our true selves and our highest purpose. We learn in the deep interior and under the stars the injunction to be in the world with its prescribed roles and hierarchies, but not of it. We find ourselves, as Walt Whitman describes, both in and out of the game. We practice wildness so that we may live more fully and constantly in the midst of anima. We learn to live in the midst of our own deep down natural animal soul, and when we have claimed our wildness, we will find ourselves with Emerson, Whitman, and Mary Oliver, and many, many others in true solidarity with the poor and with those not at home in our quantified, commercialized world. No, wildness won't save us from doubt and grief and life's misfortunes, but we will not run from them embracing America's commercial cultural illusions to assuage our anxiety and fear. And my friend Phil said shortly before he died, in life's thicket, we will have created a clearing for our wild selves. And in that clearing, in the face of confusion and worry, in the face of failure and loss, in the face of death itself, we will lift our noses to the moon and sing, knowing that we are free and one with the earth and the sun and the animals, and all who are wild and free at heart. Wild thing, you make my heart sing. Wild thing, I think I love you, and now I know for sure. Let us please stand to sing our concluding hymn, hymn number 303, We Are the Earth Upright.